Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd her career get there?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.
This is the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There? And my guest today is Ruth Holman, who is the founder and executive director of Share. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you for having me.
Thrilled to have you and get this going. We had, on my part, my error, a few cancellations and reschedules. So, and then a couple of technical difficulties getting started here, but we are all set and ready to rock. So let's jump right into it. Let's start with Share, and then we're going to go backwards and talk a little bit about you growing up. But for starters, just kind of give a quick overview of what Share is.
So Share is everything self-help support groups. And self-help support groups, you've probably heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there are 750 different types of self-help support groups just in Los Angeles County, where Share is located. And they totally changed my life, and I felt that everybody needed to know about them. And so I started Share. So Share has two self-help centers where some 120 different support groups meet each week for all different sorts of issues, childhood trauma, any sort of addiction, any sort of mental health issue, any chronic illness, relationship issues, any life transition or things like that. And so we have two centers where that happens, and they have a total of 5,000 visits every month. On top of that, we also have a housing program that uses self-help support groups. So I don't know if you know, but Los Angeles is the homeless capital of the country because we have so many people arriving for their Hollywood dream, and the weather is good so people can live outside successfully. Mm-hmm. And we decided to start a program where we have a house with a self-help support group in it, so that we put people in the house who are homeless, who were homeless, they're not homeless anymore. We get the owners of the houses to furnish the house completely and equip the kitchen. And so everything that you need to live is in the house, and it's a the cost to live in the house is very affordable on Social Security disability, so that if people have severe mental health issues, they can live in the house. And it's a very successful program in that at any one time, 57% of people who are of employable age have jobs. And this is just totally unheard of in the mental health community, to have people with jobs. In other mental health programs, it's often less than 1% of people have jobs. And we do this by giving them social support, which has been shown to be 40% of what causes good mental health is social support. So by putting them in the house that is a support group in and of itself, and encouraging them to go to other support groups in the community, they're able to get their lives together, get a job, move out, and no longer be, you know, home and leaving homelessness behind and leaving disability behind as well. So that's another one of our programs. We also run what they call a peer respite, which is a house where people with mental health issues can come, and for 2 weeks, we we give them life skills by saying, okay, you've got $4 a day to eat. Figure out how you're going to eat. And it doesn't take them long to realize that they've got to get together and pool their money to
split a pizza or something that's
right. Or learn how to cook and go shopping and all sorts of stuff like that. And then we take, you know, we introduce them to self-help support groups. We introduce them to how to envision a life 5 years from now and using backwards design, which if you ever want to get a goal accomplished, the best way to do it is to figure out what your goal is and then move backwards from that peer, you know, from there to where you are today, rather than moving forward. And the research on that shows that you'll get there two or three times faster. If you start, you know, we start them with 5 years. Okay, where do you have to be in 4 years, 3 years, et cetera, all the way down to today. So we have that program. And then we are, we've been training peer specialists. President Biden in his State of the Union address this year talked about needing to create more paraprofessionals in mental health and substance abuse. And we train paraprofessionals in to connect with people and improve their outcomes. And of course, part of that is getting them into self-help support groups. So that's probably a good understanding of what SHARE does.
So I'm going to I'm going to circle back to SHARE a little bit later in the conversation, because obviously the work that you're doing is not only hugely impactful. You know, I always think about, and I don't know of a cleaner way to say it, but I always think of like the ripple effect of every little moment that we do in life, right? And every, you know, something as simple as, you know, and I'm using this example, but like telling a child that they did a good job and how that sticks with them, right? Or giving, you know, grownups or anybody for that matter, right? Like dignity to stand on their own and overcome challenges, and just the ripple effects of the work that you've done over your entire career and what that means not only to that person, but to that person's family and the extension of that. So I always get really, really touched when speaking with people like you who have dedicated a long part of their career to helping others become their best selves. So before we talk more about SHARE, I want to go back to kind of where you started on this journey. Talk to me a little bit about Ruth as a kid. Where did you grow up? You know, only child? Did you have siblings? What were you like as a kid? What did you want to be, air quoting, when you grew up?
So I was the fourth child in 4.5 years, born to parents. My father, his father worked in the Roosevelt administration, and back then people didn't move, so he had no father growing up. And my mother's mother died of tuberculosis after I think my mother saw her mother twice between age 2 and 10 when, so here are two people who have no idea how to raise children, and they had five of us, my younger brother coming 2.5 years after me. So needless to say, it was a rather dysfunctional family. And my father, was a professor of economics at Yale University, and he took a 2-year sabbatical to Pakistan when I was 5 years old. And so I spent 2 years in Pakistan in first and second grade. And then we moved back to New Haven, Connecticut, and we rented for 1 year, and then we change schools again. So lots of school changes along the way here. And then my father decided he wanted to do more hands-on work. He worked in economic development. And we moved to Geneva, Switzerland, where I spent a year in as a day student in a boarding school, and then changed schools yet again to French speaking school. And my father then decided he didn't like the job in Geneva, and he was going to move to Washington, D.C. for another job. And that happened when in Switzerland they have 13 years of, it's like they have a 13th grade. Mm-hmm. And so I hadn't gotten a diploma. I got told on December 24th that we were moving back, and I'm in Switzerland and there's no internet. And my older sister had been applying for colleges. So she gave me all the applications she didn't want. And I had to apply for college in the U.S. And I ended up at Oberlin College, which had the second highest suicide rate in the country at that time.
Where is that? What state? What city?
It's in Ohio.
Okay.
It's in Oberlin, Ohio. And the highest point in Oberlin, Ohio, for 40 miles around, was the hill that they built when they made the swimming pool. that the coach used to train his football players to run up.
Wow.
And you could bicycle. It was totally flat. You could bicycle, but the only thing you would see was cornfield after cornfield after cornfield. So it was not a good place for, and they had classes 6 days a week. So in the meantime, I had met an Australian family through my father's connections at his new job. And they asked me what the capital of Australia was. I had been taught in my Swiss French school that it was Sydney, because that's where the Swiss had their embassy, but that was incorrect. It was Canberra. And I was so embarrassed that I decided I needed to know more about Australia. So I decided to take a junior year abroad. And Australia is, their academic year is March when does it end? I've forgotten when it ends, but it starts in March rather than September. So my second semester, sophomore year, I headed for Australia and spent a year there and realized that the education that I was getting there was much better than what I was getting at Oberlin. So I stayed and finished my degree and what they call an honors degree, which is the equivalent of a master's in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And then decided to get a job in a ski resort as a cook. Because one of the things that happened when we were in Switzerland was that my father he was at the level where he had to entertain regularly but didn't have an entertainment budget.
Uh-huh.
So my mother wasn't allowed to work because she didn't have a visa to work. So she took cooking lessons from a a chef who had graduated from Cordon Bleu in Paris. And she decided that she would cook up until the moment, I would cook with her up until the moment three guests had arrived. And then she would join the party and I would do everything else.
That's one way to learn.
That's one way to learn. So I was a really good cook. And so I got this job in a ski resort as a cook. And then I ended up having a ski accident and having a concussion, which just basically knocked me out for 2.5 years. Came back to the U.S. And after my concussion got into, you know, after I got through that concussion, I decided I wanted to go back to graduate school, applied to UCLA. And I was studying my undergraduate at the Australian National University in Canberra was economics and anthropology. And I decided that I would continue in anthropology. I was interested in economic anthropology, which back then nobody could understand how the two of those were connected at all, because there wasn't an economy anywhere except in the US. I mean, it was really not a big picture at all. So I went to UCLA and then spent 3 years in Thailand doing field work as a cultural anthropologist. And I had everything I wanted in my life perfect in Thailand. It was like everything possibly that I needed there was what I needed. And I couldn't figure out why I still wanted to kill myself all the time. You know, I had all of this suicidal ideation going on. And it was because I had been sexually abused as a child for many years. And so I went back to the U.S., left my house and my car and my computers and all my books and everything in Thailand, thinking that I would go back to the U.S., get into therapy, and if I wasn't better in 3 months, I would kill myself. And I got into therapy, and the therapist told me I needed to take more than 3 months, and I've never been back to Thailand. And instead, my therapist turned me on to self-help support groups for people who had been sexually abused as children, and they totally changed my life. The first time I walked into one of those meetings, it was the first time I ever belonged anywhere. And when they were one of the meetings that was very important to me was what they call an anger release meeting, which is part of the adult children of alcoholics. My parents weren't alcoholics, but anybody who has dysfunctional family stuff can go to an adult children of alcoholics meeting. And they had these anger release meetings. And my first husband, who was very abusive, and I was a battered woman, the day that we were to finalize our divorce, he hung out in my attorney's parking garage and pulled a gun on me and tried to kidnap me. And in the anger release meetings, they have this line that says, "You have the right to fight back." Mm-hmm. You know? So instead of getting in the car with him and Cher and me, I wouldn't be here today. I ran and screamed. And then when we couldn't have, we used to have 7 anger meetings a week, and the hospitals decided that they couldn't have them because of liability issues, and the churches didn't like us screaming, swear words and whatever. I didn't tell you that one of the things that I did in Thailand during my 3 years there was I got the governor there to ask for some Peace Corps volunteers. And we got a Peace Corps volunteer, and she couldn't think of any things to do because she didn't speak Thai well. And I came up with a legal yellow pad size list of things that she could do. And she took one look at it and said, no, I'm not interested. And I decided that, gee, these are all great ideas. Let's do them. So one of the ideas was UNESCO had paid to create a World Heritage Site in the province that I was in. And nobody there, it's like when I arrived, I was redheaded, so I have freckles everywhere. And nobody had ever seen freckles before, and they thought they were three-dimensional on my arm because of the way that, and when a woman finally touched me and she said, it's smooth. but no one spoke English. And all of a sudden we're going to be descended upon by everybody going to bringing buses of tourists in to see this World Heritage Site, which was a huge area with palaces and temples and all sorts of stuff. So they wanted me to teach people English, and I could think of nothing more boring than teaching English. So I came up with the idea of getting people who were backpacking through Thailand to come for a free dinner in exchange for teaching English, French, German, or Dutch to the locals. So we would have 100 students, and they'd be divided into the 6 o'clock group and the 7:30 group, and we would feed all of these foreigners. I put flyers up in or posters up in Bangkok at all the guest houses where the college students hung out, and said, "Come to Sukhothai for a free dinner and, you know, teach English to Thais or teach."
Yeah.
And so people showed up. We gave them free dinners. And what was interesting is everybody learned the language so much faster than they would have in a traditional, because tonight they had somebody from England. Tomorrow night they'd have somebody from Sweden. The next night they'd have somebody from the US. The night after that they'd have somebody from Canada, then Australia, then New Zealand. And our conversations all go the same way. It's like our first question is, what's your name? The Thai's first question is, how old are you? Because you don't learn somebody's name until you're going to use a kin term for at least 3 days before you learn anybody's name. So you're going to call them older brother or mother's younger sister or father's older brother in terms of what's going on. So every night, you know, they get a little bit further. You know, we're interested in how many brothers and sisters you have, what do you do for a living, and things like that. They want to know what you eat, you know, is a very important question for them. And they're very interested in whether or not you're scared that you're never going to be able to find your way home, because they memorize every tree and bush, and it's like you could drop them anywhere in their province and they would know where they were based on what vegetation is around them. So they couldn't imagine knowing 10,000 miles worth of how to get someplace. They did all of this. So we had fluent people talking, not writing, you know, within 6 months, and they could hear any accent. And, you know, and it wasn't boring at all because you got a new person to find out about every night. And it went, you know, it was very successful. So that was one of many different projects I then did. I got farmers that didn't have enough land to support themselves to take their bullock carts. So in India, they don't eat cows, but everybody's got a female cow. So where are all the male cows? Well, they get taken from India across Burma into Thailand. And in Thailand, they have only castrated bulls, I guess.
Yeah, yes, right.
They call bullocks. So they have these hand-carved carts that they use to carry stuff around, and the bullocks drag them. So I organized the farmers to talk to the tour companies. You know, we went to Bangkok. In each one of these projects, I would get somebody else who was Thai to run it. And I would invest $200 of my money into it. And then they would, I trained them to do it, and then they would continue doing it.
How did your experience? I have actually a series of questions after that. How did your experience living, working overseas shape who you are?
Oh, majorly. I mean, the way that I describe that is, other people want to think outside of the box. And I don't know where the box is because I've had such major, you know, I've spent 14 years living in other societies. And so I see solutions for problems that other people don't see because everybody divides the world up differently.
Very well said.
So it has made a huge difference. You know, if you don't read a lot, travel.
I love that.
Yes.
I love traveling. And my favorite part of traveling is going and sitting somewhere and just being immersed in the culture of wherever I am. What for you prompted you to start Share? Was it
so here I was, my husband had come after me with a gun, the anger meetings had saved my life, and they were all getting shut down. And I thought, well, if I can run these, you know, micro development projects in Thailand where I speak the language but I don't read and write, you know, I should be able to solve this problem of a place to have anger meetings meet. And so I put together a small committee, you know, put out flyers to all the meetings I was going to, and invited everybody to my one-bedroom apartment for a meeting, on a Sunday in November 1991. And by January 1st, 1993, we had a building. I found a building that had a lawsuit on it, and I convinced both sides of the lawsuit to let me use the building because it was being vandalized. You know, it had graffiti on it, and so we had a free building for a year and a half, and then the lawsuit got resolved, and we had to move out, and everybody was upset that we had to move, but it was like, no, they did us a favor. And, you know, the building didn't have any meeting rooms in it. We decided we needed meeting rooms, and that 6 was an optimal number. And we had to build in our own meeting rooms. I went to the retired senior volunteers, got a contractor who had a bad back, and he sat in a director's chair and told us what to do. And we learned how to build walls and put everything together. I mean, I think what my gift is seeing resources where nobody else sees them. I mean, I went to Thailand to save the world, and I wanted to make life better. And all I could see all these resources everywhere that nobody saw as resources. And that's where I was able to help people start businesses and get them, get them doing stuff that
they might not have otherwise seen
they,
or been able
they
to.
They didn't see or know about, exactly. You go ahead. I can talk about this forever.
Well, I love it, and I could listen forever. Talk a little bit about mental health and in your perspective of it from either what you see and share or your personal experience with it. Is it talked about enough? If people feel like they're struggling with their own mental health, what to do, how to get support if they're in Los Angeles or, you know, listening to this podcast somewhere else.
So the biggest myth about mental health is that it's all about medication. Do you think that has anything to do with the fact that the drug companies make a lot of money off of medication? Okay, medication counts for 10% of mental health, whereas social support counts for 40% of mental health. And people with mental health issues have very small social networks. So the best way to deal with any sort of mental health problem is to increase one's social network. And the quickest way to do that is to join a self-help support group. They're essentially free. They may pass a basket and ask you to throw a dollar in. You know, you don't have to. None of them require that you do that. But the first thing to know is the more people that I know and the more people who are like me that I know, so I don't feel that I am alone and totally unique in facing the issues. That right there is going to improve my mental health tremendously. There was a huge study in Canada where they have single-payer health insurance. Mm-hmm. And they looked at everybody that had bipolar in Canada. And they wanted to see who was disabled and who wasn't. Okay. And it didn't matter who their doctor was. It didn't matter what their symptoms were. It didn't matter what medication they were taking. It didn't matter whether they took medication or not. None of those determined who was functioning with bipolar and who wasn't. The only thing that made a difference was their social network, what they called tangible social support. So if you've got bipolar, get into Recovery International is a great support group to go to. Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance is another one. These are places that you can totally transform your life by creating that social support. The same thing for schizophrenia. You know, in our society, we think once schizophrenic, always schizophrenic. But in India, where people who have schizophrenia are seen as, you know, the reason that people think someone has schizophrenia in India is because God talked to them. And so when you have a wedding, you want as many people with schizophrenia at your wedding as possible. you know, in the US, we're trying to figure out, do we invite them or do we put them at the table with the pillar that, you know, so nobody will, right, at the back of the room where nobody will see them, okay? Right. So in India, people, there's a World Health Organization study that's gone on for like 60 years now, where they look at people with schizophrenia from, I think it's 42 different countries. And what they find is that in India, where people with schizophrenia are revered, 67% of people with schizophrenia will never have another psychotic break after 2 years from their first break. And that's not because they're using medication. Okay, so they're cured. 67%. Wow. All right. The number in the United States is 30%. And we don't even hear about that. All we hear is once mentally ill, always mentally ill. So by giving people their social network, which is what the self-help support groups do, we can turn people whose lives would be, you know, meaningless and lost into people who have a full, meaningful life that they can go on with. And the same is true with depression. You know, therapy for depression doesn't work as well as self-help support groups for depression. Why is that? Because it's a one-on-one relationship. Mm-hmm. And the person needs other people to be with them. So you can call Share. We have an 800 number. It's 1-877-SHARE, SHARE 49. And the way you remember it is 49. We're in California. So 49 is the California, you know, the 49ers. We're the 49ers. Okay. And that's where the 877, 7 times 7 is 49. So that's how you know which 800 number we've got, okay? 877. And all you have to remember is to put Share in the middle, SHARE, and we can help you find a support group. Or you can go to our website, shareselfhelp.org, all one word.
And what advice? I have one more question tied to Share, but back to you personally. Also, what advice would you give your younger self?
Don't worry, you'll find something to do. It's like I didn't end up starting Share until I was 32. And before that, I really didn't have much idea of what I was going to do with my life. You know, I like the anthropology stuff, but I realized that I didn't want to be a professor. You know, my family, it was, you can be anything you want as long as you're a university professor. You could be a biologist. You could be a sociologist, you could be a musician, you could do anything you want as long as you're a university professor. When I decided I didn't want to do that, I became a black sheep in my family.
Do you believe that where you've spent your time and what you're doing now and what you have been doing for, I mean, your career is what you were born to do?
I don't think it's what I was born to do. You know, I think I've made, you know, I really benefited from the What Color Is Your Parachute book, mm-hmm, and from Debtors Anonymous, which talks about find out, you know, what you would do whether you got paid for it or not, and then find a way to get paid for it. It's like, look for passion. Don't look for job. Mm-hmm. And that has really, really helped me tremendously in terms of doing something. You know, I really enjoy making the world a better place. I enjoy helping people. I like talking to people. You know, and being with people. And when I discovered the self-help support groups, I thought everybody needs to know about them. Mm-hmm. And that's where Share came about.
It's interesting. I always think that, you know, people go to the gym to exercise, keep their body physically fit. And I just feel like, and whether it's self-help support for different needs or whatever it is, but that outlet or therapy or whatever it is to just keep the mental health part, you know, balanced, I always think is just, feel like it's often overlooked and underestimated how important it is for just maintenance.
And there's such stigma attached to it. And what's wonderful about the self-help support groups, the Harvard study found 18% of Americans had been to a self-help support group of one kind or another. Nobody in the U.S. is 18%, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of what's going on. And not only are there groups for all of the various different issues, there are groups for anybody who knows anybody who has any of the issues. So even if you're not the one with a mental health issue or an addiction issue, there are others as well. And let me put out a really good call there for Recovering Couples Anonymous. Mm-hmm. Don't get divorced before you've tried Recovering Couples Anonymous, because it really will make a huge difference in your relationship.
Good to know. I didn't even know that that was I hadn't even heard of that. And the 18% statistic was also news to me. So I feel like you are a wealth, as I expected, but a wealth of information and knowledge. And I love that you're not only what Share does, but also just on this podcast, right? Like the myths that are surrounding mental health, how people can get support, how people with loved ones with mental health issues can get support, and just all of it together. So one more question for you. How do you define success?
Ooh, that's a hard one. So the first thing to know about success is that failures are success as well. Okay, when I was in Thailand, I was running 5 different projects at a time because I didn't know how things worked, and I'd run into a problem someplace. And so this one would get stopped up, but this one would start going again. And while I was doing this one over here, I discover a solution for the one that was stopped up over here. So recognizing that I learn from failure, you know, I look at it like we're the ocean, okay? And there's this ugly cinder block wall on this pristine, beautiful beach. And every time I get into a situation, you know, I smash up against the cinder blocks. But there's a little bit of sand that falls off the cinder blocks. And then I can take that sand that I've learned and smash up again. That builds. So when I run into barriers, I'm able to see that the learning from that barrier, you know, that's one of my huge takeaways, is learn from my failures. Learn from, you know, have everything planned out and it's going to go well, and I learn and it doesn't. It's okay. Just keep going and learn from that failure. Don't beat myself up about it. Don't get angry at other people about it. Just keep going. And eventually that, you know, cinder block wall is not there anymore and the beach is beautiful again.
I love that. Eloquently said. I love that. Keep going. Is there anything else before I get into, I'm going to get into rapid fire random questions about nothing that we've talked about so far. Before I do that, is there anything else that you would like to cover or talk about that we haven't covered yet?
The, you know, everybody can benefit from a support group. Try a meeting 6 times before you decide whether it's helping you, because we don't recognize how social support works. It's like people are expecting a class and they want to learn a whole bunch of stuff when they go, and it doesn't work that way. It works that when you start getting that social support, all of a sudden, my whole outlook on life changes. So try a meeting 6 times. There are lots of alternative meetings. If you have an addiction and you're not into a spiritual program, there are lots of other programs that work. There's special programs for African Americans. There are also special programs for Christians and for Asians and Buddhists and Muslims. And so don't think that the first group that you go to is the only one out there. And if you need help with that, again, call SHARE, 1-877-SHARE-49.
I was in my head as you were doing that. I was thinking, I remember the phone number because of your trick and tip there. So, all right. So I'm going to go into rapid fire that is unrelated to anything that we talked about. Just first thing that comes to mind. It's maybe 6 or 7 questions. This first one might be a little unfair. West Coast or East Coast?
West Coast.
Grass or sky?
Sky.
Stone or brick?
Stone.
Astronaut or deep sea diver?
Astronaut.
Cable or Netflix?
Netflix.
George Clooney or Ryan Reynolds?
I don't know who Ryan Reynolds is. I have to pick George Clooney.
Fair enough. I don't know if this next one might be a stumper then. Meryl Streep or Anne Hathaway?
Meryl Streep.
All right, there you go. I feel like Meryl's a classic. You always got to pick Meryl anyway. Ruth, thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed our conversation. I feel like I could really just sit here and talk to you for hours, but I can't because we both have stuff to do. But I really, really enjoyed it. So thank you again.
Let me tell you that I so appreciate what you're doing with me and with other women, because when I turned 18, I had no role models of women and how to get to the next place. And that was really, really hard not to know that it's possible and there are people to look up to and, you know, get a mentor, try stuff. If it doesn't work, it's okay. You know, something will come again. And, you know, try out a self-help support group because they will totally change your lives.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Again, my guest is Ruth Holman, who is the founder and executive director of SHARE. Ruth, thank you so much for being here.
You're very welcome.
And we will see you next time on the Lauren Asghari podcast, How'd Her Career Get There?
Let's talk a bunch of different topics.
How'd Her Career Get There?
This is a podcast with Lauren Asghari.